Good afternoon, everyone, and a very warm welcome on this frosty day. I'm Sophie. I look after the marketing events and community here at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts. Before we unleash today's brilliance, I'd like to take a moment to ground ourselves. We are gathered on the ancestral lands of the Gadigal people. For thousands of years, these lands and waters have been a stage for powerful storytelling and deep wisdom and community. We acknowledge their fierce and enduring connection to this country, and we pay our respect to elders past and present who have kept the fires of truth-telling burning bright for generations. So, a little bit of housekeeping before we begin. Can we ditch the distractions, please? Phones on silent. Let's actually be in the room together, unless you want to do some quick sneaky pics of Tim and Michael and share them on socials. That's okay. There'll be time for questions at the end. Our format here is if you can please raise your hand, we'll come over to you with the microphone. We are recording the session. It will be shared via our newsletter and on our website. And I've just got a couple of dates for your diaries. Our next talk is with the phenomenal Judy Morrison. That's on the 28th of July. There are still a couple of seats available tomorrow for the Bad Book Club with Candace Fox and Sue Turnbull. But you have to book that through the Bad Book website, not the SMSA one. And our next film is on the 8th of July. It's a special school holiday screening of How to Train Your Dragon. It's at 10:30 in the morning, and you're welcome to bring your kids or grandkids or whatever. And then afterwards, the librarians are doing a wild Christmas in July thing in the library on level two. Now, to the reason you actually got out of bed today, I have the absolute pleasure of introducing Tim Ayliff and Michael Brissenden. These two magnificent gents spent decades reporting from some very interesting places and clearly decided that factual reporting didn't pay well enough. They turned to a life of crime fiction, which is a relief because I'm not sure orange suits either of them. Tim's Dark Desert Road and Michael's Dust look at rural communities, corruption, and the rise of what Aussies so endearingly call cookers, or self-labelled sovereign citizens. So I've got two heavyweight journalists, two masterful crime novelists, and a topic that will keep you up all night. So please make some serious noise for Tim and Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's quite an intro. I hope we're not the only reason you got out of bed this morning, but we'll take it. Always love doing events with Michael. We're old friends from the ABC and both a fan of each other's work, which is always helps. Do any writing this morning, Michael?
No. I actually delivered my manuscript last week, so I'm having a little break for a couple of weeks before I start again. The endless hamster wheel of writing crime fiction.
So today I think we're just going to, in a way, interview each other, and we're going to leave heaps of time for questions from you as well, so please get those ready. It's a great turnout. Really appreciate you coming. And, Michael, we probably should start with our books.
Go on. Tell us about your book, Tim.
Well, Dark Desert Road. Elevator pitch. I'll just try an elevator pitch. So twin sisters, Billy and Kit McCarthy, they've had a difficult childhood. Their father is an ex-soldier. He's a violent man. He's been accused of war crimes and he's pretty angry at establishment. And a sort of traumatic event happens for the identical twins, Kit and Billy, in their sort of early teens, and they both react to this in different ways. Their father assaults their mother, and Billy somehow finds a way to forgive their father, and Kit cannot. So fast forward the clock, Kit and Billy haven't seen or spoken to each other in a decade. Kit is now a cop. She's 29 years old, or they're both 29. She's working in child protection. She gets a message out of the blue from her mother saying Billy's been in touch. She's got a young son and somebody's trying to kill her. And then Billy disappears. So Kit has no way of trying to contact her, and the only lead she has is unfortunately from her father, who's serving a life sentence for murder in Goulburn Supermax. He's graduated to full white supremacist inside. He's a sovereign citizen, kind of anti-establishment person, and Kit visits him in Goulburn Supermax, and he says that Billy has shacked up with this ex-US soldier, and she's living in this sort of community somewhere in the New South Wales Riverina, and that's all Kit knows. But the bond between twin sisters is strong. She knows that she needs to go and find her, help her, and meet the young nephew that she never knew she had.
It was a very long elevator ride, wasn't it?
Are you going to do this whole time? I'm timing yours.
Okay. So my book is Dust, and it opens with a young man called Aaron Love, who's living in a caravan park beside a lake which has dried up and pretty much disappeared. And as the lake dries up, they're discovering all sorts of things in the bottom of the lake that people had wanted kept hidden. And 2 years previously, his father disappeared on the lake. They found his boat and they found his ute, but they never found a body. And Aaron did not have a very good relationship with his father, so he thought he'd take this opportunity to go and see if he could find any evidence that the old man actually had died. So he goes out into the lake bed. He doesn't find any evidence of his father, but he does find another body, a fresh body, and it turns out that that body was also looking for his father.
40 seconds.
See, that was only about 12 floors.
You know, the hard thing when we're doing an event like this and you're talking about the book. So I wrote the first draft of this book 2 years ago, and I've written two in between, and I'm three in between actually, including these kids' spy thrillers that I'm writing. And I'm writing at the moment the sequel to Dark Desert Road. So I'm in that wrestling phase of it, around 10,000 words, trying to work out exactly what the book is, but it's great reuniting with the characters, hence probably why it took me a little bit longer to do my elevator pitch. So here's a question for us to ponder together. The role of fiction in public discourse, where do you stand on that?
Well, look, I think one of the great things about fiction is that it allows you to discuss all sorts of things that we couldn't discuss in the same way within the constraints of journalism. So in a sense, fiction allows you to sort of cover off on all of the nuances of particular things without actually beating somebody over the head with a particular journalistic type story. In fact, you know, I find I have to sort of pull a lot of the journalism out of the writing as much as possible because you need to give the reader agency. But for instance, I think in both of our books really, but in Dust, It's no spoiler alert. The father, you find out this pretty quickly, the father actually is still alive. And he had disappeared down a sovereign citizen rabbit hole. And we both ended up writing about this experience without really knowing the other was doing it, simply because I think we were reflecting what was sort of coursing through the world really at the time. And one of the things that I think that we do as journalists writing crime fiction is engage with what the current sort of zeitgeist of the world is. And when you're writing crime fiction, we're writing something that is essentially a reflection of our world back at us. And people have to believe that it's possible in a sense. So, you know, you have to write about... we're not writing fantasy, we're writing sort of current contemporary crime fiction, so we are reflecting the world. And I actually find it a very liberating experience because you can talk about, well, for instance, I don't think you can write about, at the moment, about regional Australia without looking at some of the issues that are dividing the nation, you know. One of them is the energy transition. And what's happening in communities and how that is playing out. So it's not the be-all and end-all of everything you're writing, but it's sort of in the background. That's the things that people are living through. The housing crisis is another issue that I think we often think of that as being a big city problem, but actually it's a huge problem in regional Australia. people living on the margins, you know, all those sorts of things were things that I wanted to explore within the realms of fiction and a good story, so that with crime fiction you can keep people engaged in a story, but you can also say a few things about what's actually happening in the world.
Yeah, it's quite liberating. I remember you once saying really early on, I think I was interviewing you for one of your first books, and you said, maybe your first book, you said you can get to much closer to the truth in fiction. And I agree with that, and I think it's not surprising that both you and I with these books, they're very different books, but we do touch on sovereign citizens, and that sense of alienation and being left behind that is being felt in regional Australia. And we saw that particularly during the pandemic, where people out in the bush were feeling like they were being forgotten by government and left behind.
But I think our books are a reflection of that, right?
That
post-COVID period where, yep, you know, really did have an outsized impact on people.
Yeah, no, it did. I remember I'd written my book and it was coming out 6 months later, and Dust had just come out, and I'm reading Dust. And I remember I can't remember how long through it, and I rang Michael and said, "Mate, you've got twins and sovereign citizens. What the hell's going on?" He said, "Keep reading. Don't worry. It's not what you think. Our books are different." And they're obviously very, very different. But for us, jumping on the zeitgeist in a way, and like we're exploring real world issues, so it's not a surprise that sometimes that we are in the same places, although this is probably the closest it ever got.
Yeah, this is as close as it ever got.
Yeah.
Won't be this close again, Tim.
No, it won't. No, of course not. Of course not. We just don't tell each other things anymore, no.
That's right.
I really love exploring real-world issues, and I've always said with my books that everything in them either has happened, will happen, or could happen. And I know that you write that way as well, which is incredibly realistic. And for readers to be able to get a sense of an issue, I think using characters to do that, you know, creating a story that takes them along for the ride. And I think something that sometimes is harder in nonfiction is to really show the impact of something, whether it's violence or whether it's the change or whether it's a struggle. Being able to create a story around that in fiction, I find is a really powerful tool. And I think it's why we all love, you know, watching film and TV and things at the same time, because you get to explore the world in different ways. And with regional Australia, a few stories like sharing from my research trips and afterwards. I remember I've just bought an electric car, and I was talking to a friend of mine who's a real country boy, lives out sort of Wagga on a farm, and I said to him, I said, "Mate, do you reckon you'll ever get an electric car out here?" And he said, "Tim, I'll drive a diesel till I die." But this is where it's sort of at the moment. I mean, there are those that are really on the renewable energy transition in regional Australia, and then those who aren't.
Well, it's a very divisive issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of it is, you know, the fault. There are a lot of fault lines in that, and one of them is the media, and one of them is politics, and one of them is, I think, you know, obviously social media as well, and how misinformation or fear is weaponized by consistently and constantly by people wanting to take advantage of it. And seriously, I think the political discussion in this country, and particularly in regional Australia, has been weaponized and has changed a lot. And part of the responsibility for that, I think, is that social media, for a start, has given people license to have much more aggressive or fervent political, or to state those opinions more strongly. And something like Sky News, which is on free to air in regional Australia and is playing everywhere in the background of almost everywhere you go. If you go to the pub now, you'll find Sky News and the racing, you know. And that's having an impact which is far greater than it's having in the cities, for instance, because I think you have to still have to pay for Sky News in the cities, but it's free to air on the 10 network in most of regional Australia. And I think I've noticed over the last probably 5 to 10 years that has coincided with the social media explosion, and it has given people license to be far more politically aggressive with each other.
Yeah, I agree with that. Sky News, a lot of people that were really rusted on ABC viewers and listeners in regional Australia are now finding themselves rusted on Sky News viewers. And Sky News is a channel of grievance.
Yeah.
So, and that's what in many ways Pauline Hanson is doing right now as well, which is that I'm talking about what everything that's wrong in this country without actually having any solutions to those problems. And that is the big danger at the moment. And you look at, I can't remember the name of the senator, but he spoke in the Senate the other day after Pauline Hanson had done her press club address, and he was talking about the fact that the media is failing to properly investigate what's going on in social media, with whether it's potentially AI or Gina Rinehart or
see the reaction to the budget in AI,
yeah.
Right? And how...
quickly.
And how quickly Anthony Albanese was standing next to small business people who were complaining to him that it was killing their business. And it was just all bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, it was just completely fake. And I went to the gym 2 days after the budget, and the owner of the gym said, oh, he's coming to take all my money away. You know, I've been seeing it all, and, you know, I'm going to give 50% of my income to, you know, to Anthony Albanese. I said, where did you get that from? He said, oh, it's all over the internet.
And we, this is sort of what's
happening.
And
that's not regional, right?
And look, exactly. we saw it with the U.S. election in 2016, of course, where you know Russia was found to have you know been a huge factor in the result of that election, with putting out misinformation campaigns and. There's a danger that something like that's happening now, because if you look at the enemies of democracies, the fastest way and most impactful way you can in disrupting that democracy is to actually mess with information.
So apparently publishers are looking for the next thing they're looking for is the big AI thriller. So get to it, Tim.
Dear idea, a lot of pressure. Michael Connolly wrote a really good AI thriller, I've got to say. So anyway, I won't dig into this too much, but the one last kind of thing I'd say about it is that the number one source for many people in this country, and it's getting edging to be the number one source for everybody in this country for news, is Facebook. And Facebook, Meta, says it is not in the business of news. So go figure. What's actually on those platforms? And I think the only way to fight back against this is actually, and I think over the next, I hope 5 to 10 years, that with what we're seeing with AI at the moment, because we're sleepwalking into AI the same way we sleepwalked into social media, and governments are missing it, they're failing to regulate it, failing to tax these businesses properly, that the one thing I'd say is there's so much misinformation out there now that maybe it's going to drive people back to trusted or traditional news organisations that are renowned for known for actually telling the truth and doing good journalism, because now there's just so much out there that is fake.
Maybe. And you know, hopefully.
Or not.
You know, and I think a lot of people are finding some relief in fiction too, to be honest, because it's...
Let's get back
you
to
know,
that.
It's somewhere else to go that's a little bit, you know, a little bit removed from the horror that is our current reality.
Yeah, well, let's get back to fiction. I've depressed people enough. So when I was watching this really great video of Dervla McTiernan the other day. It was an interview she did on local radio. She was talking about the magic of when you're writing something and it just starts coming together, and you go, "Actually, I've got something that's good here." When does that happen for you?
Good question. Different times, actually, to be honest. I mean, I often, you know, people talk about people who plot everything and people who don't, and, you know, I'm not one who necessarily plots. I never know where the end... I never know what the ending is, for instance. But I do have a couple of characters when I start. I do have an image of something, and I do have a couple of sort of thematic things that I want to hit, and some things that I know are going to happen. I'm just not sure how I'm going to get to them. And sometimes... it surprises you and you're going along and you just, it starts to work and the characters start taking the story in a direction you never saw coming, that is a very exciting place to be as a writer, you know.
Yeah.
I really enjoy that moment when you think, wow, I never would have got here if I had tried to plot, you know, like one thing after the next, I would never have got to that point because I would never have seen it.
Mm. I'll come back to the plotting thing in a minute, but I'm in that position at the moment where I'm still really wrestling with this story. It's 10,000 words in and it's frustrating.
But a second. Sometimes it doesn't work. Like the last book I've just finished, when I first started, I got 15,000 words in and junked it because it wasn't working and started again, right? So,
yeah, well, I mean, I've got a story to rival that one. Was when I wrote my third book called The Enemy Within, and you're going to have to give me a bit of leeway here. It takes a while, this story. But so I was in Europe for work. I was in Germany, and I said to my wife, I want to set my next book in it's going to be part in St. Malo in France and the other part of it in Portsmouth, because I wanted to have the boat that goes across. Yeah, well, we'll come to that, Michael. So I said, look, do you mind if I just duck over there? I'm going to tag a week on to the end of this work trip. So she said, yeah, no worries, very supportive. And so I went and did it and then got back and then spent this year writing this book on weekends because I was working at the ABC at the time. And then I finished the book and delivered it and I thought, all right, this is feeling pretty good. And I had to wait a few weeks to hear back from my publisher, and I said, when she called for a meeting with me, and I said, what do you think? She said, it's good. It's just not great. And we need great, because it's book three in a three-book deal. So I said, so what do you think? She said, well, you've got two options. Like, I really like the far-right white supremacist sort of thing you've got working in here, but it's not really marrying with the other plot line. And I'm wondering whether if you brought it back to Sydney and then we talked about a different idea involving AFP raids on the ABC and had the warrant that was used to raid the ABC that day. So I started thinking, maybe, yeah, okay, maybe there's something in this, and I'll... So I went away and she said, so you're going to have to delete half the book or just start writing something else. Just start writing something else. So I thought about it and I just thought, okay, I'm just going to have to start this thing again. So it was a bit more than 15,000 words. It was a whole book. But then I plotted and planned that one out more than I'd planned any other book before, and I think it was my third book and it was my best book then at the time. An author always says his latest book is their best book, by the way. But I was really happy with the book and the process that enabled me to write it that way. But I had to junk a whole book. Mm. And sometimes you have to, because we owe it to you as a reader to write something better every time we sit down to write, and it means going through a little bit of pain, doesn't it? Mm.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's an important part of the learning process. You know, as fiction writers, we're learning all the time as well about our own process, about what works, about how, you know, I would like to hope that the books keep getting better and better and better.
Yeah, and on the question of the tax issue that I then had for that little research week.
What did you do with all those receipts from St. Malo?
Well, I wrote a couple of chapters in St. Malo in the next book. And, you know, if the tax man ever answers questions, I'll say, have you read Killer Trader Spy? Yeah. So there you go.
Mm.
all right, we're going to talk about plot. So character or plot, what's more important?
To start with, character. But the character often tells you what the plot is and defines the plot in the end. So the biggest surprise moments actually for me are when the plots actually start to work, you know, because you can write yourself into a corner and not really know how to get out of it. So it's nice when it all starts to coalesce and work. But you have to have the characters. I think you can follow character through plot holes, but you can't follow plot with character that isn't working.
Agree. I think for me, and I'm interested, maybe we'll do a show of hands here, because what do you think, plot or character? Plot. Who says plot?
There's a few.
Right. Yeah. Character?
Yeah, look.
Okay, we've got character. So I think...
I mean, ideally you get both to work.
Look, beautiful. Both have to work. Yeah, you've got to have both, right? So neither answer is wrong. But when I think about the most memorable books I've ever read, what do I remember from those books? It's usually the character, the characters that you identify with. So for me, creating those characters, and maybe that comes back to that idea earlier, we were talking about truth in fiction and the fiction's role in public discourse and role in our world, that why it's so powerful for me is character, because that's where people either see themselves reflecting back off the page, or other people, or the things that they might, you know, fear or want to know more.
True, but I also think, as you know, as journalists, we tend to rely too heavily on plot sometimes, and I think you need to give the reader much more agency than spelling stuff out, you know. And character can help you do that. Character can help bring the reader along through plot.
For us in our jobs now as novelists rather than journalists, I feel like not much has changed in a way in terms of still trying to chase the truth. And I'm interested to talk a little bit about, but I want you to go first, around some of the research you do, because we're talking about characters, and then when you're trying to research a topic, because there's usually underlying topics in our books. Talk a little bit about Dust and where those characters came from.
I just had this thing about...
Or Smoke as well, actually. You got a really great character in Smoke.
Smoke was much more sort of a research-based novel because it was set in California and I had to go there and do more research. But in Dust, you know, I just had this... I'd been reading a lot of American crime and, you know... particularly looking at the way Americans look at communities of disadvantage and the crime that is sort of curse those communities in a way, and I wanted to sort of transfer that to Australia, to an Australian experience, and that's where the image of the lake came from. Actually, it came because I was reading about Lake Mead in Nevada, and it was drying up, and it was revealing all these things in the bottom, including bodies, because the mob. Who, you know, Lake Mead's only 70 miles from Las Vegas, and the mob had been dumping, you know, people with concrete boots in there for years and years and years. And so the lake drying up, I loved that image of the lake revealing these secrets that people had wanted hidden forever. But I wanted then to use that to try and get into some of those things that we were talking about. And I had, you know, we'd all had experience of the sort of post-COVID cooker type environment, and you know, you don't have to go too far when researching that sort of stuff, actually, you know, it's that sort of stuff's here. But I do think 40 years of journalism has given me an ability to research things that I didn't have perhaps if I'd tried to write novels in my 20s, and one of the things it's given me is not necessarily taking no for an answer on the first call, and knowing who to call, and knowing how to get information from people in a way that I probably wouldn't have done before. So, when it came to the sovereign citizen stuff and whatever, I mean, I know a lot of people, and I know a few people now who I can talk to in the intelligence community and whatever who'll tell me things. I know a few people in the police who'll tell me things, so you know that helps helps inform the way I write. But the more difficult problem was in Smoke, which was set in California, and the central protagonist of that novel was a 43-year-old female sergeant who was under investigation, and she was from the LAPD, and she got basically furloughed from the police force and went back to the town that she came from, which had been burnt out by a big bushfire. And you can imagine how many people ring up the LAPD and say, can you tell me, you know, I'm writing a book, you know, can you tell me how it works? And they even have a special department to deal with people who want to do that, and the department is completely useless. So I went about trying to find some LAPD people to talk to me, And I did get a couple of people who sort of said, well, look, you know, I can't promise anything. If I'm in town and you're here, just give me a call and we'll see if we can make it work and whatever. And I left on a research trip for 3 weeks, 4 weeks to California, and I didn't have anybody in the police force to tell me how. I had a lot of questions about how this would work, because one of the problems is if you get furloughed from the police force in New South Wales, you can easily be moved from the city to a small country town because it's one police jurisdiction. California has 76 police jurisdictions, so it's a different proposition. And this 43-year-old female, I needed to know what would happen when she was under investigation. I needed to know where someone like that would live in LA, because LAPD cops don't often want to... they don't want to police their own neighbourhoods because they don't want to be running into the people they're locking up. It's a pretty dangerous place. And also they don't get paid a lot of money, so they can't afford to live in Hollywood. You know, they've got to live somewhere. Anyway, I had nothing. I get to LA and I think, well, what am I going to do? So I'll go up to the police academy. And I drove my hire car up to the police academy, and it's the big white building you've seen in the police academy movies. That's exactly it. I drove into the car park. There's absolutely no security. And there was a live firing exercise going on in the paddock next door. And I walked up to the front door and walked straight through the front door. There's absolutely no security. I'm going, okay, this is interesting. Nobody around. I walked through the next door and it's the armory, and they're all strapping on their... strapping on their bulletproof vests and they're checking their weapons and all the rest of it. And this guy says to me, he says, what are you doing here? I said, oh, well, I'm an Australian writer. I'd just like some information. He said, sure, come with me. I'll take you down to the chief's office. So I went down to the chief's office, and the chief wasn't there, but there was a 43-year-old female sergeant who gave me everything. She sat me down for 2 hours and gave me every bit of information that I needed. So I think, to cut a long story short...
That was a long story.
Yeah, that was a long elevator ride. But I would not have had the wit or the nerve to do something like that 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah. I think being a journalist, you know, gives you the, I guess, the confidence to just knock on doors and that. But also I think I've found, maybe it's why I became a journalist, but I just love talking to people. And listening to people. Yeah. And so in researching Dark Desert Road, I spent quite a bit of time driving through the Riverina, and got some old sort of school friends and people I knew through there that I'd stay with, or they'd show me around and introduce me to people. And the reason I chose the Riverina is because I've got bikies in the book as well, and it's a well-known drug corridor, you know, reaching all the way down to South Australia and then all the way up to Queensland, where drugs are trafficked through. But also, in wanting to explore sovereign citizens, it's most likely they're going to be in regional and more remote areas living off the grid. I was influenced by that horrible attack in Weeyambilla involving the trains. Gareth and Nathaniel Train and Stacey, Nathaniel's wife, they killed two police officers and also one of their neighbours, and they were living off the grid up there. They were they subscribed to a form of Christian fundamentalism called Christian Identity, which believes in the second coming of Christ, and they had lost faith in all institutions and were sort of living that life. And they'd been communicating with extremists in the US. So in Australia, they estimate in the hundreds, but I think it's probably in the thousands now, that there are in the low thousands sovereign citizens. In the US, there's about 500,000. And they'd been communicating. You may all remember a guy was charged in Arizona by the FBI. He ended up being convicted for lesser charges, but he had... There's communications from him egging the trains on in terms of they're taking up their arms against the so-called establishment. So I had to set it in regional Australia. Desi Freeman hadn't happened yet when I wrote the book. But this groundswell, I think, of like mistrust and disillusionment was growing. And so I spent that time, you know, out in the Riverina talking to cops, spoke to a guy in the US as well, ex-sheriff who's a counterterrorism specialist. And I think for us as journalists, that's what we do. You know, we've got good contact book, but we're not afraid to ask those questions and how to frame it so that they know it's fiction but they get it, you know.
There's a bit of serendipity or luck as well that comes into it, you know.
Yeah, there is.
Like I was in Dust. Central to that is a trucking route, and a guy who the guy has gone down the rabbit hole is running a second set of books and using the trucking route basically as a trafficking operation. And I was sort of riding this away. I think, wow, this is maybe a little bit too fantastic, you know. Surely this, and they were using bikies to then transport things between, to sort of transport the goods. And anyway, I contacted a friend of mine who you'll know, Adele Ferguson, and I said, what do you think of this? And she said, oh, that's exactly what, that's it. There is this trucking company called Viking Trucking in Victoria who's been done for exactly that. You know, I thought, oh, my God, really? So, you know. But the other thing I wanted to explore was a guy I used to work with many, many years ago became a truck driver. He was a journalist and he became a truck driver, and he kept on at me about, doing something on the trucking industry when I was working in Four Corners. And one of the things he was telling me about was Tarcutta, which is halfway between Sydney and Melbourne. And the trucking companies, to save money, they send a driver from Sydney and a driver from Melbourne, and they get to Tarcutta at about 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, and then they swap and they drive back home again so the trucking company doesn't have to put them up anywhere. And I just thought the opportunity for malfeasance at that point, where there are all of these trucks, and you go to Tarcutta and it is just like this big concrete apron, right? During the day, there's nothing on it. At 1 o'clock in the morning, it is humming. It's just booming with trucks. They're all coming in, they're swapping over, they're swapping drivers, they're having showers, they're eating food, they're doing whatever they do.
And drugs and sex workers?
Well, actually, I don't know if that's the case, but I said it was. Well, just the opportunity.
You said you did some deep research, Michael. Yeah.
The opportunity for the opportunity for bad things to happen at that moment was too great for me, so I put it in the book.
You know, just thinking about that, the research, and then that question around character we talked about earlier. Sometimes it's the small characters as well, and I wrote a character in this book. He's only in there very briefly, but when I was travelling through the region, I was having a few beers in a pub, which is where a lot of your conversations happen, by the way, when you're researching books like these, and which is terrible. So this guy walks in the pub, this tiny little town just outside Griffith, and he's wearing high vis, he's got this tiny little dog with him, a little Jack Russell, and he walks in by himself. He just sits up at the bar by himself, orders a beer, and he's sitting there. The dog just sits obediently at his feet. And I love dogs. I'm a dog person. So I left the two guys I was talking to at the table and I went over to him and I started having a bit of a chat. And I said, oh, mate, do you mind if I pat your dog? He said, yeah, no worries, mate. He's sipping on his beer and we're chatting for a while. And he looks down and he says, yeah, that dog saved me during the pandemic. If it wasn't for him, I'd be hanging from a tree around the corner. And I just went, whoa, like that told me more than I needed to know about how he felt and what he experienced during the pandemic and what it was like living in regional Australia. And I pretty much wrote that directly into the book, obviously without identifying him. But so that's a character, such a small part in the book, but such a huge statement for me.
Yep. That's 1:15. Should we take some questions if there are some? If anybody's got any questions. Here we go. Oh, sorry. There's a microphone coming for you. Yeah, follow the rule.
Firstly, I was born and bred in Sydney. I've lived 50 years in regional Australia, so you've kind of got it reasonably nailed, but we're not all cookers.
No, but that's the point. It's become more divided and more more socially divided because of all of that.
Yeah, it's a tricky scenario. Look, I'm in a little bit interested in the concept. You both talked about writing in the zeitgeist, you know, what's current. I've been a long-term reader of Peter Corris' books and his great series with Cliff Hardy. Obviously, over 50 years of writing, the character morphed, had to morph. Do you see any longevity in the novels that you're writing in terms of, you know, when you look back, one day someone looks back and writes the biography of Tim Ahlef and says, look, you know, he wrote a great, you know, lot of books that were, you know, that lasted the distance, etc. Is that something that's important to you, or are crime writers really just writing for the market for the moment? In other words, do you see... if there's any sense of, or do you desire any sense of writing something that will stand the test of time because it's talking about deeper things than the current zeitgeist?
Well, do you want me to go first?
Go for it, yeah.
Look, I would like to think that the books will stand the test of time because of the fact we're writing about deeper things, but also because it's a moment in time. So we're quite contemporary with what we're writing, so we're nailing some issues that are bubbling along in the world right now. But I love reading books. I've read many Peter Corris books as well, and I love going back or reading a John le Carré book. I don't know that it makes it less interesting. I think it potentially makes it more interesting if you've captured what was real in the world at that moment. I think that novelists that sort of chase the market, there's a lot of rural noir novels that are being written at the moment, small town murders, and there's some really great ones, and then there's some not great ones as well. I don't know that those books are going to stand the test of time because they could be set at any time. So I don't know. They're telling us a lot about the world.
Well, no, I think if you read Peter Corris, you can get a great idea of what Sydney was like in the 1970s, right? You know, I mean, it's... and that will stand as a sort of historical moment that will always be a reference point, but an enjoyable one to do. You know, you could go and read a history book, or you could read some Peter Corris about, you know, what it was like in Glebe in 1976. You know, like I think that's great. Yeah,
and I think if you become known as a writer who's doing that, then it probably makes people maybe want to go and pick you up down the track. Because they're going to get a sense of the world as it was then. I've got a really nice Peter Corris story. When I started out on this writing journey, it's going to be a short elevator pitch Peter Corris story. I reached out to him through a friend who knew him, and I said, could I catch up, could I buy you a beer or a coffee? I just wanted to pick your brain about writing. And I'd just written my first novel, The Greater Good.
Would have had to go early in the day.
Yeah. Yeah. So Peter then was in the final sort of year of his life. He was unwell, and he said, but what would you like to know? I'm not well enough to catch up. And I just sent him some basically open questions, really. And he said, well, on the question of my writing regimen, I write in 2 1-hour sessions every day, each with a large glass of white wine. Old school.
That's right.
Basically. Well, we can talk about that for a long time as well.
I remember Chris Hammer speaking about how Peter Temple was one of his lecturers and how Peter Temple was pretty pedantic about how to write. I'm just wondering, who inspired you to be such good journalists and later good fiction writers?
I was not lucky enough to have... I mean, I know people... I'm an old friend of Chris. We went to school together, and I know a lot of people who went and studied at Bathurst when Peter Temple was was one of the writing teachers there, and he is legendary. Like, you know, he'd write in the side, in the margins, go and be a plumber, this is hopeless, you know. But people learned a lot from him, for sure. I grew up in a family of writers, so my father was an English academic at the ANU in Canberra, and he was into, his specialty was 18th century poetry and modern American poetry, neither of which I was particularly interested in as a 14-year-old, But he had this amazing crime and thriller library. He was always reading crime and thrillers, and he was constantly reading them. So my first engagement with reading really as a 15-year-old was with his thriller library. But, you know, I said I wasn't very good at anything when I was that old, except I got a job. I worked for the school newspaper, and that was the only thing I'd ever done where people had said, oh, you know, given me sort of positive commentary about it. You know, I could go and interview somebody, come back and write 600 words, put it in the school newspaper, and people would say, oh, that's really good, that's really interesting. Never happened to me before. So, you know, you have those conversations with your parents and, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I want to be a journalist. And my father said, he don't want to do that. He said, they're all drunks and frustrated writers. And in a way, he was right. But anyway, that's sort of where I've ended up.
Look, similar to Michael, that my parents, particularly, both great readers, and Mum, very, very interested in the world, like real sense of adventure. She did the Trans-Siberian Rail on her own when she was about 20. She's 80. So that sense of adventure, I think, was instilled in me and from her and wanting to learn a lot about the world. And then my dad is a writer as well, and we've got sort of writers in the family. Dad, they'd always put books in my hands, and Dad, you know, particularly, you know, pushed me to challenge me and to read, you know, different things from a young age. And I actually had one of the greatest privileges of my life this year, in that I launched my dad's latest book for him at Manly Writers Festival. He's 82, and he's written a memoir, which is a very good book, called Betrayal, which is about the broader victims of the Catholic Church's failing to deal with child sexual abuse. So he's interviewed a lot of families that lost children, and then children as adults. And also it sort of stems from the idea for him, stemmed from something that he was asked by the most senior Marist brother, a guy called Alexis Turton, in the late 80s to help him cover up for the Marist brothers what had been happening. He asked them to effectively wanted to help him spin the messages in publicity, because Dad was an advertising man. And Dad didn't know much about the what had happened, but he just knew that he wanted to know part of it. And he said, if there's people been doing the wrong thing, you need to go to the police. But he always carried around this could I have done more thing in his, you know, in his mind. And so after the Royal Commission, he sort of started writing this book, and it's called Betrayal. So that was a really, really a big book for him, but just an amazing thing for me to be able to do to launch his book.
Oh, it was a great thing. I wish, you know, what an extraordinary moment. Mm. Absolutely fantastic, yeah. Get back to Peter Temple for a moment. I mean, I don't think I still think Peter Temple is probably the best crime writer we have ever had. And a great inspiration, actually, you know. And you can read his books, and they are as fresh today as they were when they were written. You know, it's amazing. Yeah.
You know, the one thing I'd say about Peter Temple, because everyone's on the love train of Peter Temple these days, and I think it's great. Yeah, he wrote amazing characters, but his plots were terrible.
Even he admits that.
Yeah.
Like, he says, you know, I'm not very good at plot.
Yeah.
But this is to the point we were talking about before.
Yeah.
It didn't really matter because you were so invested in the characters and what they were doing and how they were getting from one point to the next.
Exactly. And I love Peter Temple's books as well. So I was just, you know, being controversial there. But character is king, and that's, I think, he was the master at writing those. Any more questions?
I have one.
Yeah.
Made some notes.
Oh, look out.
Okay. Oh. This is one I prepared earlier.
Do you think media literacy has dropped since you were both working as journalists? And do you think, the second part of the question is, the TikTok generation seem to be more media literate, are able to see more clearly, I think, through the slop that comes through places like Sky, but I'd be interested in hearing your opinion.
They certainly recognise it, which is true. I think our generation in particular don't recognise it. My kids, for instance, know immediately if something's AI. They just know it. my wife keeps sending my daughters things. Oh, look at this. Isn't this amazing? You know, and they come back, Mum, that's AI. So, you know, yeah, I think there's a fair bit of that.
Well, AI slop was the Macquarie Dictionary's new word edition last year, interestingly enough. It's a thing. I think you're right. I think that... I mean, I'm learning stuff from my kids every day as well. Younger people, they've grown up with devices in a way that we haven't. I just think there's a huge challenge at the moment that people of a certain age, it's all of you in the room, it's us, that we grew up at a time or have been consuming news thinking that what we're reading, there's good journalism behind it or there's truth behind it. It's been shared with us, therefore it must be true. Someone's taken the you know, gone to the trouble to write about it or create something, that it must be true. I think we need to be questioning more.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think we really understand where it's going or what it's going to mean and how it's going to impact on us.
I hope that... I'm right in what I said earlier, in that there is just so much crap out there now that maybe everyone's going to start mistrusting everything.
Yeah.
So that then they're going to go looking for places where they absolutely
know
it's
true. Which is actually pretty hard, because you get emails from people you think, oh, this looks legit.
Yeah.
Is it? I don't know.
It's hard. Yeah. Yep.
I just wanted to return to you said character is king before, and you both spoke about sort of discovering plot or characters as you write them. I know, like, for instance, Tolkien also speaks almost with surprise or curiosity about the characters he just came across in the act of writing. And I was curious if you as the authors are not necessarily the creators of your characters, if you're discovering them along the way, what is the relationship to your characters?
Absolutely, I definitely agree with that.
And how does that compare with, say, a journalist and your relationship to the people you discover in the act of...
Well, as journalists, you shouldn't really make it up. But, you know, as novelists, we can... One of the great delights about writing novels is that you can make it up and it can go anywhere you like. And in Dust, for instance, the central protagonist of this is a cop who is in his 40s, and I got sort of about a third of the way through writing this and I thought, actually, this guy really needs to be challenged by something big, you know. And I thought, well, what is the biggest thing that will challenge a cop like that, is who's sort of disillusioned with the whole thing? One of the biggest things would be if he had a child who was breaking the law. And how would he deal with that? And what would be the moral dilemma that he would be faced? But he actually admires partly why the child is breaking the law. And so I had to invent, like, a character had to come to me through that, that I didn't see coming. And I didn't see that character coming, and actually that character turns out to be central to what happens in the rest of the book and central to the plot.
Sometimes my characters are based on real people, so I could be drawing from many different people. I plot a bit more than, like, Michael does and some others that just sort of sit down and get going with the book and let it unfold. So sometimes if I know that some of the big beats of a novel, then I find myself meeting the people that are caught up in those.
Yeah, it's great
very
fun.
Few of us make heaps of money from it.
Yeah.
So journalism's always going to be there. It's really important. If someone has that burning passion to be a journo and tell stories, do it, for sure. Yeah, I'd never
absolutely.
Say not do that.
But just the golden years of journalism are sort of gone, yeah. Right? I mean, when the newspapers had lots of revenue, they invested a lot of money in correspondence. We had a lot of competition. We had, you know, the commercial television networks were very profitable. They were investing money. Everyone was investing money. It meant the ABC had to keep up and have a point of difference as well, and sort of invest more in certain areas of journalism, particularly in foreign correspondence and those sorts of things. I mean, it's all gone now, you know. Like, I mean, the newspapers have maybe one correspondent in New York, you know, maybe someone in London. That's it. and the ABC has halved pretty much its the number of correspondents and the number of positions that are basically available for people to get through that middle part of their careers. You know, plenty of people can get a start in journalism now as young, cheap, young reporters, but there's very few opportunities in the middle of your career when you start having kids and you have a mortgage and you can't, you know, like they just don't pay properly. They don't pay enough. And there's a few, very few, who are sort of the older journalists, and most of those people are starting to leave.
Doesn't pay enough for what the job demands of you.
No, it doesn't.
No.
Yeah. Sad. It is sad. Yeah.
And worrying.
Yeah.
In a way, because, you know, where else does truth, well researched truth, come from?
No, that's right. I absolutely agree. I think it's a bit of a crisis, actually. Yeah.
You can find it in fiction. So, on that note, I should definitely want to just thank Michael and Gordon from Woollahra Bookshop for coming here. It's huge, and thank God we still have bookshops in this country.
That's right, exactly.
In this city. Thank those guys, and not just to support us, but support them if you can fancy a book.
Yep.
Exit through the bookstore. Thank you, Michael and Tim, so much for coming along today. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for coming.